Senate Committee on Revenue and School Finance Agenda, February 19, 1981. 1:30 p.m., Hearing Room 137, Work Session. Senate Bill 65 clarifies definition of federal income tax as applicable to State Personal Income Tax Act. Senate Bill 68, create warrant procedure for unpaid timber taxes. Senate Bill 64, property tax exemption strictly construed.
Committee will come to order. We're going to, Ron, are you going to be able to be here for a few minutes then? We'll start with Senate Bill 65. I believe it's Ira. Ted, do you want to come up on 65? So it's just Ira alone? Oh, okay. We've held one hearing on 65, and we were talking about some amendments, primarily technical in nature. And Ira, you have those?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Ira Jones, Assistant Attorney General, here representing the Department of Revenue. I did discuss several places where the bill needed to be amended before, and I have those typed up for you so that you can look at them. These are the very simple ones. The first amendment is found on page 1 of the bill in line 20. And remember, we wanted to just delete individual because as the law stands now, any adjustments to federal income tax can be made only to individual taxpayers, and that would exclude estates and trusts, which are also under the Personal Income Tax Act of 1969, which is found in ORS Chapter 316. So by eliminating individual, then we
pick those up.
We'll pick those up. And I think the department generally has been up until the 79 Act, there was no problem, and with this language put in, did we find out then that we couldn't
picking up
treat
trusts
everybody.
And what other kinds of
estates and trusts primarily. The next change is on page 3 in line 12. There, for some reason or other, when we were when the Act was amended to tax domestic insurance companies, life insurance companies, somehow we referred to the annual form of the Insurance Division of the Department of Commerce, we say for the year 1968, and the Second Amendment would delete year 1968 and insert taxable year, so it'll be for the taxable year, because the Department of Commerce from time to time changes those forms a little bit, and I'm sure that no insurance company since that time has ever gone back and put the material back on the form for the year 1968.
Which tax is this referring to? The
this would be the corporate excise tax, and this would be the corporate excise tax on domestic in life insurance companies. And then the final amendment is on page 5, line 5. You remember there was some question about the where it said that the amendments to 316072, that's the ones that make it clear that amounts paid by employees for Social Security taxes would not be deductible as federal income taxes, that would apply to all tax returns open to audit or adjustment on the effective date of this act. And what we meant was on and after. And there was even some question among the staff of the Department of Revenue that perhaps there might be some return slip in somewhere that we couldn't adjust, even between the time that this became known, as soon as this bill was printed, and before it became effective. So in line 5, we'll delete effective date of this act and insert and after January 1, 1981. So it'll read all tax returns open to audit or adjustment on and after January 1, 1981. And there aren't going to be anybody now that, because they learn of this bill, can somehow meet the statute of limitations. So it'll be administered consistently all the way through.
Okay.
I move the amendments.
Okay, Senator Dernstead moves the amendments. Are there questions?
I have a question.
Senator McFarland.
And I'm sure that we've done this before, Mr. Jones, but explain to me again what we meant by Section 4. The Act you're mentioning says it changes an erroneous cross reference. I understand that. But to the correct reference, but permitting domestic insurers authorized, etc. Tell me what that.
I'm not even sure that I got a copy of the explanation that.
Well, or maybe you just can tell by looking at Section 4.
All right. This act again defines what is going to be net income as far as a domestic life insurance company's income is going to be for that return. And it in subsection 3, down on starting on line 34, it talks about income, expenses, gains, losses, exclusions, and deductions. And other items properly attributable to one or more separate accounts authorized under, and ORS 73180 has been repealed in the meantime, and it has been recodified as 733220. So it's just really correcting, it's not changing anything, it's just correcting a reference, but it talks about what certain items that are on this report, this annual statement, that are not going to be taken into account in computing a domestic life insurance income, and that's those items that are set forth in that particular section, shall not be taken into account in determining taxable income of a domestic insurer.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, are there further questions on the amendments before us? Senator Dernstead has moved them. No questions before we vote? Clerk, call roll on amendments.
Senator Hanlon?
Aye.
Senator Dernstead?
Aye.
Senator
McFarland?
Aye.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Senator Powell? Aye. Motion's adopted. The amendments presented by the Department of Revenue dated 2/12/80 by Ira W. Jones have been adopted. Okay, Ira, it might benefit the committee now if we would go right back to the bill, now that we've amended it, and look at each provision. And I know we're going to talk about the deletion of the subsection 6 of one section. Was it sub D of section 6 on the sheriff's question and that policy decision? But why don't we, can we just go back to page 1 and have you briefly explain the language?
All right, Mr. Chairman. The language in Section 1 of the bill does two things now with the amendment. One thing, it deletes individual, as I've explained before, out of line 20, so that now any changes in federal taxes will be taken into account by estates and trusts as well as individuals in the year in which the change becomes final with the federal, whether you're on an accrual basis or a tax basis taxpayer. In other words, if you say you filled out your 1978 return and in 1979 it was adjusted and either you got a refund or you paid additional tax, you take that refund into income in 1979 if you had received a tax benefit in 78, or you will take an additional deduction if you can in 1979 rather than relating it back to 78. That's primarily the purpose of subsection 4.
Can everybody understand that part of it? Just simply picks up estates and treats them as it would an individual?
Right.
Okay.
Subsection 5 is added because at the time that the Personal Income Tax Act of 1969 was enacted, when it talked about the federal taxes that were deductible from federal taxable income and arriving at adjusted gross income, it did not carry over these same provisions into the new law. Now, why, I don't know. The Personal Income Tax Act of the Property Tax Relief Act of 1929, the first provisions such as this were enacted in 36 and again amended sometime in the early 40s. And then the Personal Income Tax Act of 1953 had this language in, and I think the part that's in subparagraph B was added somewhere in about 1961 or 62 or 63, somewhere in that area. Because and why this language wasn't picked up when the 69 Act was enacted, I don't know. I think it was just an oversight. And therefore, what we are wanting to do is to pick this language up and say that for purposes of Chapter 316, any taxes, contributions, or other payments paid by employees in pursuance of federal law relating to Social Security, railroad retirement, unemployment compensation, or old age benefits is not going to be considered federal taxable income.
Yes.
And the same way the taxes paid pursuant to the Self-Employment Contributions Act.
Is not going to be considered as
federal taxable income, okay, as a deduction.
Would you, on line 24, the word taxes, is that standing by itself, or does that relate to the verbiage that follows on Social Security? Are we talking about Social Security tax? And is this the same language that existed prior to?
Yes, this is the same language that existed prior to. And taxes, it is. In fact, in the Internal Revenue Code, it talks about, when it comes down to speaking of Social Security taxes, says there hereby is imposed an income tax on individuals equal to such and such a percent to be deducted from their wages, and a light tax on employers, mm-hmm, and so on down the line. And so what we're trying to do here is just make sure that the amount that employees pay is not a federal tax deduction under the Act.
Okay.
And this is the way we've administered the Act very consistently.
The reason I raised the question is to make sure that we're not taking away federal income tax as a deduction up to the limit.
No, we're not really changing that at all. That's in another section of it.
So the word taxes there is actually talking about,
well, you see,
Social Security tax.
Go back to the first. It says, for purposes of this chapter, federal income tax does not include the following, the taxes for Social Security or old age benefits or whatever,
okay,
they might be.
Okay. But if you simply read that and then stop at the comma, it just simply says taxes. But you're talking about word taxes means Social Security
relating
tax.
To Social Security and all the rest, and under any of the federal laws relating to Social Security, railroad retirement, and so,
okay,
on.
Okay. Because that "or," I think, put them together. But
it hasn't given anybody any,
yeah,
trouble, really.
I just want to make that clear on the record, mm-hmm, that that's how we view it. Senator Monroe.
Some people read the Bible that way, too, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Chairman, this is the language to say that was in the statutes up until 1969.
Yes.
I can't think of any, but have there been any other types of taxes levied by the federal government since then?
Quick.
Not that I'm aware of at all, Senator. Not at all.
Other questions? Okay. Next provision. We're cleaning up.
Okay, the next
section
is
adjusted basis.
Adjusted basis in 316.109, ORS 316.109. This was a bill that was passed can't remember whether it was a special, I think it was the regular session, in the last session of the legislature. And this resulted from a case that was before the Supreme Court as to exactly how you tax the gain on the sale of residential property, whether you have a kind of an Oregon rule, as that case certainly suggested, or whether you decide to completely follow the federal. It was the decision of the legislature that a personal residence would become taxable in Oregon only if that same income were taxable under the federal law. And furthermore, the legislature also said that the same basis that was used on the federal return should be the same basis that is used on the state return, and the statute just used the term basis. About the time, just shortly before adjournment, one person called to my attention, well, shouldn't that be adjusted basis instead of just basis? Because everybody talks about basis when they talk about the sale of property, they mean adjusted basis. And technically, that's what it should have been. Well, and so to stop any lawsuits in the future, we're asking that adjusted be inserted into ORS
316.109. Okay.
Section 3 amends ORS 316.162. Among other things, it takes out some of the sexist language. But the primary reason for bringing this to your attention, really a couple of reasons. One is on line 25 to delete the reference to section 26A, title 49 of the United States Code, because in the last year, the federal government has recodified section 26A, and if you look in the annotations of the U.S. Code, you'll find now it is sections 1512 and 11504. And so we're deleting the obsolete reference and putting in the correct reference to that particular section of the federal statutes. And then the two deletions, starting one on line 37 through 40 on page 2 and on page 3, lines 6, 7, and 8, have to do with a special provision that was in the law that only related to the period after December 31, 1970 and before July 1, 1975, which let certain persons who were engaged in the motion picture production or television production or for television commercials under certain circumstances to not withhold. They had to make certain applications for exemption and had to say that yes, their people would pay the tax and so on and so forth. Well, it's long after July 1, 1975. Those provisions don't mean anything anymore, and the legislature has chosen not to continue that act, so we felt that they should be deleted.
Senator McFarland.
Where did that section come from?
You mean that's being deleted?
Yeah.
That was very carefully lobbied, I guess, by the motion picture industry. That's all I can say. Okay. But there was a lot of discussion about it. And
now John Lynn's dead.
It must have had something to do with some specific filming that was going on.
There was some filming going on. There are several motion picture...
It signed contracts, Paint Your Wagon. And
I think that was the one really that started it, was Paint Your Wagon.
I think that's where Cow Patty came from, the song.
The next amendment would be found on page 3, line 12, which is the one I already talked to you or spoke to you about, the deletion of that year 1968 and put in taxable year, so that we're talking about the right form of the Department of Commerce. And then the other reason for putting this section in the law was the correction of the reference to chapter 733 down in line 35. 733-180 has been changed and repealed, and it should be 733-220 is where those same provisions are included now. And then section 5 amends ORS 317.225 by eliminating from that list of statutes that are going to be recognized when you're talking about a sale or exchange of property, deleting the reference to 317.250, again another section which is has been repealed, and the provisions put into 317.
Thank you very much.
Well, no, I guess it was just outright repealed because it wasn't needed anymore.
Okay. Section 6.
Boy, I don't have my
explanation. Section 6 deals with the who serves, allows.
Okay, I think ORS 118.490 had certain provisions dealing with compensation of personal representatives, which is already covered in the present probate code and really conflicts with the present probate code and isn't needed anymore in the inheritance tax law.
Okay, behind the bill in your packet is analysis, and bottom of the front page, section 6 is analyzed somewhat there. You might be able to follow him along.
And I'm not
okay. 490 duplicates 116.173, so you're simply eliminating to get rid of the duplication.
119.510. Well, wait a minute. Let's go back to 119.025. That states that it applies to gift taxes for that certain sections of ORS Chapter 119 apply to gift taxes for 1959 and later years, and that's no longer needed because those would apply. Those statutes are current. It's obsolete. 119.510 duplicates statutes that are already in effect in ORS Chapter 305, which give the Department of Revenue broad rulemaking powers for all laws that are administered by the Department of Revenue, and so the duplicating those provisions in just in the gift tax laws is really superfluous.
Okay.
So that is being eliminated. And then ORS 305.210 repeals the statute which states that the county sheriff shall serve all process papers and subpoenas required by the Department of Revenue. There are provisions for anyone else and any other agency of the state of Oregon in the general statutes relating to subpoenas that either that you can do it through the sheriff or you can do it by your own, any person over 18 years of age. And why this one has been held over so that the Department of Revenue can only do it through the county sheriffs, we don't know.
This was not part of Messenger Bob's bill last session, huh?
Senator George Miller, Department of Revenue. No, it was not part of Messenger Bob's provision.
You have a contract with Messenger Bob right now.
Or any other session.
Okay.
As far as we can determine in the statutes, the Department of Revenue is the only one that has this provision tacked on to them. Whereas the general provisions of the Code of Civil Procedure, which was enacted last session, now provides that any individual of moral character or something of that nature over 18 years old can serve a subpoena. And we just want that privilege. It doesn't mean that we still wouldn't utilize the service of the sheriffs in some situations.
Okay. Okay, I think the Section 7 you've explained and the amendments have been adopted. Ira, is there anything else you want to say on that?
Well, the only thing that I haven't explained in Section 7 is that we provide that the amendments to ORS 316.109, that has to do with the adjusted basis of a personal residence, by Section 2 of this Act, shall apply to taxable years beginning on and after January 1, 1979, which was when the applicability date of the original Act was placed, so that somebody doesn't think that maybe they can take some kind of an advantage if we, during that 1 year period, if they sell their personal residence and have to pay tax, say in 85 or 90 or something like that.
Okay, there are questions of Mr. Jones on the provisions of the bill. Either of you have any more?
Members of the committee, I understand that yesterday Mr. Kennedy did go through and explain to you how the collection proceedings was going along, some of the problems that he had and so on, and made this ask if he could bring some more amendments to this bill to help the Department of Revenue, and we do have these amendments, which again would like to explain to you.
This is going to be the omnibus bill of the station.
Almost. I was going to say Christmas tree bill,
yet.
But that's not right.
The news is saying, no, we're still working on that one. 25 pages.
I presume in this amendment, Mr. Chairman, will contain the amendment that we earmark this relief act for basic schools. Is that how we do it?
Yeah.
$50 million.
Okay, Mr. Kennedy, were you going to explain this, or was Ira? Ira?
Well, I can go ahead, okay. Though I may turn to Homer here on some of these things. Actually, what these amendments do is that they add a new Section 6 to the bill and then amend two other code sections to add some additional language and just add those onto the bill. The first one is to add a new Section 6, which really provides that the Department of Revenue, or through the director, may engage the services of a collection agency to collect taxes, interest, and penalties resulting from the assessment of taxes under practically any of the laws that the Department of Revenue collects taxes under. So that, provides that the director may assign to the collection agency any of the taxes, penalties, and interests or monies that are due the state. And finally, that collection agency can take such action as it needs to including attachment and garnishment, whatever is necessary to affect the collection. Also, in the first subsection, it does provide that the director may engage the services of a collection agency by entering into an agreement to pay reasonable charges on a contingent fee or other basis, so that it does allow us to reimburse the collection agency for this. This would be helpful, particularly when we get into out-of-state collections, to turn these matters over to a collection agency and let them, because they have a lot more facilities in other states and so forth, that they could probably do a much better job than we could trying it on our own.
Okay. Ira, would we be, that language in subsection 2 talks about the collection for purposes only any of the taxes, penalties, interests, and monies due the state. Would we be, how broad is this? What are we talking about outside of taxes? What other collection duties would this give then the power then in the case of the mass transit districts they collect for to use it because it's under their jurisdiction and anything they now have jurisdiction in collecting for?
I would think that it would include those, yes.
Okay. Who else do you collect for? Other agencies?
Mr. Chairman, we collect for other agencies, but I think quite a few of the other agencies that we collect for now have the authority to either use us or private agencies. So we weren't addressing their accounts.
In essence, these people will be, although not directly representing the state of Oregon, in a sense representing the state of Oregon,
is there a history of using private collectors in those other agencies that you know of?
None that I'm aware of, Mr. Chairman. I do know that higher education uses other agents, other collection agencies to a certain extent, but I don't know what their experience is with the other agencies.
Okay. Senator Hammond.
I read the language in, either one of you, the language in sub 3, kind of broad. Feel that it's not necessary to have some qualifying language in there that just whatever action they take consistent with normal practices.
I understand the problem you're addressing, but on the other hand, it would be very difficult to try to restrict that without in some instances, I'm sure, hampering them so that they could no longer be effective.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hamill, if I could comment on that. The outside collection agencies are subject to strict federal laws in the collection actions that they take. And so they would have to work within those laws.
Things on strict construction.
In your folders, they should be the last two things in your folder. Is a copy of Senate Bill 64, and behind it is an opinion, a letter to the chairman from Elizabeth Stockdale, Assistant Attorney General, who is unable to be here today, but as a 2+ page letter specifying some history concerning how the current interpretation by the courts has sort of moved from strict interpretation to sort of strict and reasonable interpretation, i.e., maybe less strict.
Something new for the Supreme Court.
Okay. Ted, who was going to address this? Elizabeth couldn't be here. Ted DeLuce.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Ted DeLuce, Department of Justice, representing the Department of Revenue. And Mrs. Stockdale has, I think, very adequately set forth the critical cases that have developed this rule up to the time of the Multnomah School of the Bible case. I think everybody concluded that the rule of construction was that if the exemption or the claim for exemption didn't clearly come within the statutory language, that the claim would fail. It is to be noted, however, that many provisions of the law regarding exemptions have general language, especially those like in ORS 307, 130, and 140, talking about literary, benevolent, charitable, and scientific institutions. And regardless of the rule of construction, the problem always lies to the court, or is before the court, to construe those kinds of statutes in light of the facts presented. I talked to Mrs. Stockdale just before I came over, and she called to my attention the fact that many cases are ones where the result goes one way or the other because of the burden of proof. Somebody doesn't prove one thing or the other, and they're not really questions involving the rule of construction. However, I think that we would agree with the dissent in the Willamette University case that adding the test of strict but reasonable, adding the reasonable, sort of returns the rule to one where the court will decide, however it does, and these cases are very difficult, what the legislative intent was without the necessity of throwing the claim for exemption out if it isn't clearly proved. In other words, the rule, as I say, when in doubt, throw it out. But and that the court will look at it without utilizing that rule to dispose of a case. Because as Justice O'Connell said, boy, courts are always supposed to be reasonable, but if they apply a reasonable rule, this prevents the court from applying the strict rule that if there's any question at all of the petitioner coming within the statute, that they do not allow the exemption.
Okay, so in this case, would O'Connell's opinion have taxed Willamette University?
I've forgotten. I didn't.
There's a new case on that. I just heard on the radio the other day somebody has filed suit claiming that their tax-exempt status should be thrown out. Okay, the basic point being is that the courts currently use strict construction but have added a test of reasonableness and looking at maybe other similar court cases. So that it has muddied the water. Is that correct?
I would say yes, that from my viewpoint, the rule of strict construction in the sense that if there's any doubt, you don't allow it, is no longer the rule.
Mm-hmm. And in your opinion, the passage of Senate Bill 64 would reinstate that?
Yes, I think it would.
Have you any idea how many of the existing exemptions that would be in trouble with hospitals be in trouble, for instance, all the
states?
What?
Hospitals.
Hospitals? No, I don't think so.
Okay. We had testimony from somebody representing the hospitals, and they felt that although it wasn't that they did not clearly feel threatened, that they felt that there was a cause to be concerned about the language which they are applying for exemption.
As I recall, one of the early cases back in either the 1930s or 40s considered the question of the exemption of hospitals long before the court adopted a rule of strict but reasonable construction. And there, I think the issue was that hospitals do charge fees and therefore they're not totally charitable or benevolent, and the court held that they were within the statute. So I don't think that rule would change. I don't think they would have any problem.
Okay. Now,
Senator Crowell?
My question was, what exemptions then would be endowed if we went to this particular construction?
That's awfully hard to say, because one of the problems in the courts face in construing these exemptions, and this, incidentally, happened to come up this morning in the House Revenue Committee discussing the exemptions allowed churches. And the United States Supreme Court decision coming up from Maryland, I've forgotten the name of the petitioner, but she was a woman who is notorious for attacking the difference between church and state. The United States Supreme Court ruled that the day had long since passed when we could question the authority of the state to exempt churches. Well, I think the case that comes to my mind was the Oregon Supreme Court decision involving the YMCA, and where incidental services provided by a YMCA, for example, you can go in and get a haircut or something else which might be considered as competitive with other businesses, but yet if it's incidental to the total operation, the charitable operation of the YMCA, it can still come within the exemption. That kind of situation might change. But maybe my colleagues can think of something else.
The language on lines 6 and 7 of the bill, it says, if a statute is capable of more than one construction, each of which is reasonable, the construction that results in taxability for the property must be used. So if it appears to me that that language, that if one could construct a decent argument on the side of taxation, the court would have really no option.
That's right. That's right. There have been cases involving, for example, the exemption on commercial construction, 307-330, I think it is, of buildings under construction the first 2 years, where we've had problems of interpretation as to what the legislature meant by certain conditions, and where you could take one of two reasonable constructions. And I think that kind of situation would be ones where if you presented both arguments and the court saw that either of two positions could be adopted, the court would be forced to take the one most narrowly construing the statute, and in some cases might throw out the exemption. There's some cases that this wouldn't make any difference. I'm thinking of the case that has probably opened up exemptions more than any in previous years, and that don't remember the name of the case, but it involved the question of activities of church property, where property was used for printing a church paper and so on and so forth. And the court, Oregon Supreme Court, held that any activity which was religious in nature was ipso facto charitable. Well, that meant that if it was incidental to the carrying out of religious activities, it also qualified as a charitable activity, and that's why we had quite a change in the law with respect to the exemption of parish parsonages and other residences used by people closely connected with churches. They were using that in connection with the church activity. It was in connection with religious activities, therefore charitable, therefore exempt. And that, prior to that, as people could testify, there was a rule which pretty much said that if they were used as personal residences, they were taxable. But that, in that situation, I don't see how this rule would have made any difference, because that is a really broad interpretation of what is religious. I don't think that situation, this kind of rule, would apply. But when there's a statutory qualification that they had to do something within a certain time period, for example, or perform some activity, or perhaps even the ownership, the kind of ownership that would qualify. We've had some cases. Here's a case that came up several years ago where a charitable organization bought a building which they intended to use within the next year. Before they actually moved into the building and actually began what you might say a full use of the building, they went in and they cleaned the building up, they moved in some furniture, and they began the process of using it, so to speak. The court held that that qualified. Now, the question involved was actually used and occupied. And you can see that you could have different kinds of fact situations where the court could hold that that was not a sufficient use. Perhaps under a rule of strict construction, they might have given a different result. On the other hand, before this Willamette University case, we had an earlier Willamette University case in which the question arose as to whether the construction of the building, the university decided to build a building. They started the process of actually building the building. They weren't occupying the building, but the court there held that the process of building the building was an occupation and used for charitable purposes. Now, that was even before this addition by the court of the reasonable construction. So I'm hard put to say with any definitiveness what would happen, but I would say that certainly, and sometimes it's a composition of the court itself, certainly it would give weight to the argument that unless it clearly came within the provisions of the law, that the court had no choice but to hold the property taxable.
Okay. Any other questions, Mr. Lewis? Senator Monroe?
Are parsonages occupied by the minister as a residence taxable now?
They are if they have no other use. If they are used in connection with counseling, he's on call 24 hours, you could go there and counsel with him, or Sunday school classes. Mm-hmm. That kind of youth groups, all that kind of thing, usually that qualifies them for exemption.
So you're saying if the parsonage is used as the minister's residence, but he also holds a Bible study once a week in his living room or something of that nature, that he could be, it would be exempt.
Now, the counties also apply a rule of proration too. In other words, they would prorate the value of the property and determine that part of it was used for religious purposes and part wasn't.
Okay.
Used to have some interesting rules where they drew lines down the center of the hallway and things like that.
Okay. Senator Trump?
Yeah. What's the compelling reason for doing this?
I was just going to ask somebody from the assessor.
Yeah, I don't think I could answer that.
Yeah. Is there anybody from the assessor's group that would like to testify, Mr. Worrell?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Kim Worrell. I am Hill County Assessor representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. Mr. DeLuce pretty well covered the background of the interpretation of exemptions that have been.
Please just talk about churches.
Yes.
He's always wanted to get religion happen.
Same thing happened this morning. We were talking about ministers' housing.
That's what you just stay lay off those guys. Mess around.
Our problem with the interpretations of exemptions probably isn't so obvious in religious exemptions as it is in other areas, especially going into deferrals and other special assessment programs, although it does fall into the religious area too. Historically, as Mr. DeLuce said, the interpretation was that if a property did not expressly qualify for an exemption or special assessment, it did not receive that exemption or special assessment. Now, let me say right here that the assessors are not in here because we want to put more value on the roll. It doesn't help us a bit. In fact, if we could cut everything, all the values in half and let the people vote their levies and have the rates doubled, that might, you know, be easier for us to manipulate. And that's not the reason we're here. The reason we are here is that we represent all the taxpayers in an area, and when an exemption is granted, it raises the taxes on the other people. When a special assessment is granted, it raises the taxes on the other people. And we feel that we have an obligation to the other taxpayers as well as to people that are asking for or receiving exemptions. We have some examples of types of things that have happened where there would be an effect with a bill like this in action. One of them did not involve a tax court case. It involved a Department of Revenue hearing case, and this happened from my county, where we had a parcel of 4 acres that had been separated off of a larger tract that it had was receiving special farm use assessment. The 4 acres in question were part of the woodlot and were not actually in farm use, but they were separated off physically by deed. And the owner of the land proceeded to build a house on the 4 acres. After 3 years, after the separation and the house was completed, we went out to put the house on the roll and observed that the land not only was not being farmed, but never had been farmed, and disqualified the farm use assessment because there is a requirement in the statute that it has been farmed for the prior 2 years. The owner of the land appealed to the Department of Revenue, stated that he intended to buy some fencing and put it around it and pasture it, and the Department of Revenue reinstated the farm deferral based on his intent, not based on the way the law is read, but based on his intent to farm it. And somehow or other, the hearings officer had gathered the intent idea from an opinion that had come from the tax court regarding special assessments. We had another case that maybe is a step further than one that Ted cited. It happened in Marion County, where the assessor would not allow an exemption on a church that did not exist on January 1. And the decision was appealed to the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Revenue, I believe, upheld the assessor. The decision was then appealed to the tax court, and the tax court ruled that since there had been an area of the land mowed for the purpose of moving in a travel trailer so that a caretaker could move in and oversee the construction, that was sufficient to indicate there was going to be a church built there and that it should receive the exemption. I would think that under a strict construction, that probably would not have been allowed. There was no church there, it was just the land received the exemption. We had a case recently, and this is...
You know, some of the problem I have,
probably ought to direct it at the Department of Revenue as well as most of the assessors. Leave me just a little cold in this whole process because we've constantly had to fight the Department of Revenue, particularly on tax, farm tax deferral. Though you don't like the policy, the legislature has acted. We frequently have problems for both the revenue and the assessor's office constantly trying to attack this. Give you the authority of strict construction and have you then start discussing tax referral. I can tell you, you lost me a long time ago because, frankly, we've tried to pass and get it nailed down. And when you think you can find some rule, now you're on water wells and septic tanks, and we finally got the houses. And we started on this in 1967. And I guess what you're really saying is that you want it so nailed down that you don't have to use some reason and judgment with the courts. It's really called. I just wanted to tell you, as you move along, I can tell you that's just a bunch of poppycock, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, Senator Day, I think maybe we're talking from the same side you're talking from. That we would like to have.
I surely hope
that
so.
We would like to have a policy decision on the part of the legislature that, in as much as exemptions and special assessments are a benefit to the taxpayer at the expense of the other taxpayers, that they need to be, the requirements need to be fulfilled in order for them to be granted.
Excuse me, in the cases you gave us about the fence, it wouldn't apply to the one about the church, but where it's going to be built. But the one on the fence, now we have an income requirement, don't we?
Yes.
Wouldn't that disqualify that person?
Land that was already under the farm deferral at the time that law was passed in 77 were exempted from meeting the requirement until 1983.
Okay.
So they couldn't apply.
We're in the process
we're
now,
close to that now
of taking care of that, although I understand there's at least one assessor that doesn't think those income levels are necessary.
That could be.
We may have a hearing on that. In fact, let that assessor come and tell us.
We had another case where, or two very similar situations went to the Department of Revenue on appeal, one of them from my county, one of them from another county. A parcel of land was under farm deferral and was platted. According to the statute, platting disqualifies farm deferral and taxes have to be paid back. I disqualified the one in my county, and the Department of Revenue felt that that was not a reasonable interpretation of what the statute said, that the letter of the law did not apply, it was the intent of the law, and they reinstated the farm deferral. In the other county, the parcel had been platted, was under farm deferral, no, was not under farm deferral. An owner bought it for the purpose of farming it, not with the idea of dividing it, and applied for farm deferral and was denied. The Department of Revenue upheld that denial.
But it had been platted?
It had been platted, but they upheld that denial, which is a stronger interpretation than the one in mine where it specifically stated it had to be disqualified. And they're two exact opposite deals. And
it seems to me that you're dealing with strict statutory language that wouldn't necessarily solve that problem.
Well, it would if it were strict construction. If there were a requirement in there, in the case in my county, the disqualification would have been upheld because the statute said it shall be disqualified. But it was not.
If it says it shall be disqualified, I don't know how you build a reasonable argument on the other side. If it's a finding of fact that the land has been platted and the statute says it shall be disqualified, I think we're dealing with people who got up on the wrong side of the bed instead of the way things are. I mean, if it says that, I don't see any, I mean, if it's a matter of finding a fact and the word shall, I don't see that you're gonna be any better off if it says you shall be strict. That sounds pretty strict to me.
I can bring you the copy of that opinion, I will. But it did say that the letter of the law was not the intent of the law.
Okay, Senator Trump.
Sounds as though you're really pretty critical of what the kind of decisions the tax courts are making down.
In many cases, we are, Senator. Yes.
Why is it, do you think, that the tax court is going so far away from strict construction or from what had been the idea that...
Doesn't want to be overruled by the appellate courts.
That could be a reason, Senator. I've been in the assessment field now for 16 years, and this would be an observation and an opinion rather than a matter of any kind of fact. I have the feeling that anybody that gets into a position of constantly handling appeals of value or appeals of determination eventually gets the feeling that maybe there is something wrong with the system and that there needs to be something done about it, and is doing it from that idea. You know, after years and years of always hearing the fact that the tax laws are wrong, or the interpretation is wrong, or that the taxpayer is being victimized, that there may be a softening of the attitude on the part of a person that's in that position. And I don't want to label Carlisle Roberts in that position. He's an extremely intelligent, extremely knowledgeable person. But I just have the feeling that that happens to people. It happens to representatives on the Board of Equalizations in counties. The longer they're on, sometimes they start getting the idea, well, hey, all of these people are in here saying the assessor is wrong, maybe the assessor is wrong. It just seems to happen. It's human nature.
Maybe.
The other point of that is the fact that, of course, our one way for redress, people that aren't acting correctly, and maybe he's seen enough to feel that maybe the people in charge of the assessment, including the assessors, that are overhanded, heavy-handed, that could be the other side of the coin.
That's a possibility, Senator, but I think that that if anything, assessors probably tend to be the other way because of the fact they have to deal directly with those taxpayers on a constant basis.
I guess maybe I'd hate to tell you. I haven't seen that in my county, nor have I seen it necessarily in certain areas of the Department of Revenue.
Okay, I would also like to add along that line that the Department of Revenue, when I'm talking about their appeals officers, is one section of the Department of Revenue. In another section, we have the Assessment Appraisal Division that establishes the administrative rules that we go by when we're trying to interpret the laws. And most of the assessors strongly follow the recommendations of the Assessment Appraisal Division and then are overturned by the appeals section of the Department of Revenue. And it's a conflict. One of them can't control the other one. They are separate areas, and they should be.
Yes.
But that's a problem we're having.
Senator Trump?
Do you see any way in which hospitals as a class of property would be in special jeopardy if we pass this legislation?
No, sir, I don't.
They are quite concerned. Many of us have been lobbied by the hospital association to say this is going to affect us adversely. You don't see any reason why it should. Mr. Bruce said he didn't see any reason why it should.
No, I don't think that that's been a situation that the assessors have had any problems with particularly.
Private universities are also concerned with it as well.
Again, I don't see a reason for that.
I just picked up on the radio the other morning on the way in that there is, somebody did file a lawsuit just against Willamette here in the last few days on their tax status. Okay, I think you see the committee's problem when we're told on the one hand that we don't see where it's really gonna do much except for these little extreme cases perhaps, yet we're not, we don't know what we're doing with the legislation. Other than addressing a court history that has allowed the consideration of other things, other ideas than you shall be taxed.
I think this maybe goes one step beyond that, too, and it's one area that I haven't brought up, and that is the fact that the assessor's offices are creatures of the legislature. We don't do anything that isn't really prescribed by statute. And having those statutes behind us and having the statutes interpreted the way they're written makes our job easier. And that's just a flat-out statement, that if we're given a latitude in certain areas, it puts us in a position that's harder to...
I think if this bill passed, that it would probably generate a minimum of 200 bills. I do, because I think everybody out there would want to have very strict language. We shall not be taxed, period.
Yeah.
Yeah. I honestly do. I think it would create... I have no such property, unfortunately, but if I did, I'd have a bill in. And there would be no doubt that judge would strictly construe on my side, according to my bill, anyway. But I do think that that's, one way or the other, we have to decide how we're going to address this issue. We want to address it from bringing them in and clarifying the language, which perhaps should be done regardless of what happens in 64, or should we do it by reviewing them one at a time? I get copies of abuses, a case, and I sit there and I look at it, and I look at. Dealing with that statutorily is almost impossible. The church case with an empty lot, first of all, you're dealing with one tax year, I guess. And secondly, you're dealing with an area that you, if you address statutorily, you simply have to wipe them all out. And that's why we have the procedure where somebody should be able to use some common sense. And
there's one more area that was discussed with Missouri. Senator Monroe brought up the parsonages, and that is an area that the assessors have a great deal of concern with, because the statutes do not exempt residential facilities, and strict construction would not allow an exemption on residential facilities. And isn't the assessors are having a bad time with
okay,
that.
Okay, so this bill would automatically add all parsonages?
Unless they're exclusively used for resident or for religious purposes, as the statute provides, yes. That's right. It would.
Yeah. And I think that's the line that the hospitals are talking about. I don't think they're worried about their 16 stories right there. But I think they're worried about other properties they own. That's where I think they feel they're going to come under the act, and that's where I think perhaps they have a case.
It could be.
As Mr. DeLuce said, if they are cutting hair, I'm not talking about getting you ready for surgery. I'm talking about in other ways. But if they sell,
you never know. You might be okay.
If you're about the guy that escaped from the pen,
no.
Last night, what happened? They were getting him ready for hernia surgery, and he kicked the guy down the stairs and ran away. And he's dangerous. right in the middle of surgery, and he's dangerous. Where were we?
I don't know, but you were all right.
We're on haircuts.
Oh yeah, they sell magazines and gifts down in the lobby area, which is in competition with the bookstore down the street. It's those kinds of questions that that we're getting into, and it's a bigger question, I think, than the simple. Easy words, strict instruction.
Mr. Chairman, I really think that this bill is a bear trap that's going to catch a lot more bears than the one we've set it for. So I move we put this bill on the table.
Thank you, Kim. I won't let you sit there for this procedure. Was there anyone else who wanted to say something on this that had an example?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Barney Spade with the Oregon Association of Hospitals, and I'm here in place of Pete Fleischner, who's out of town, and I know he testified before the committee before, and I wanted to try to clarify our concern, because I don't think the concern of the Hospital Association runs counter to the intent of the assessors. It's just that when you look at the